Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Weight loss solutions are not one size fits all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you. With 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
The Charge at Gettysburg, from Hero Tales from American History. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by David Leeson. Hero Tales from American History, by Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt. The Charge at Gettysburg, written by Theodore Roosevelt. For the Lord on the whirlwind is abroad, in the earthquake he has spoken. He has smitten with his thunder the iron walls asunder, and the gates of brass are broken. Whittier. With bray of the trumpet and roll of the drum, and keen ring of bugle, the cavalry come. Sharp clank the steel scabbards, the bridle chains ring, and foam from red nostrils the wild chargers fling. Tramp, tramp o'er the greensward that quivers below, scarce held by the curb-bit the fierce horses go, and the grim-visaged colonel, with ear-rending shout, peals forth to the squadrons the order, trot out. Francis A. Durivage. The Battle of Chancellorsville marked the zenith of the Confederate good fortune. Immediately afterward, in June 1863, Lee led the victorious Army of Northern Virginia into Pennsylvania. The South was now the invader, not the invaded, and its heart beat proudly with hopes of success, but these hopes went down in a bloody wreck on July 4, when word was sent to the world that the high valor of Virginia had failed at last on the field of Gettysburg, and that in the far west Vicksburg had been taken by the Army of the Silent Soldier. At Gettysburg, Lee had under him some 70,000 men, and his opponent, Meade, about 90,000. Both armies were composed mainly of seasoned veterans, trained to the highest point by campaign after campaign and battle after battle, and there was nothing to choose between them as to the fighting power of the rank and file. The Union army was the larger, yet most of the time it stood on the defensive. For the difference between the generals, Lee and Meade, was greater than could be bridged by 20,000 men. For 3 days the battle raged. No other battle of recent time has been so obstinate and so bloody. The victorious Union army lost a greater percentage in killed and wounded than the Allied armies of England, Germany, and the Netherlands lost at Waterloo. Four of its seven corps suffered each a greater relative loss than befell the world-renowned British infantry on the day that saw the doom of the French Emperor. The defeated Confederates at Gettysburg lost, relatively, as many men as the defeated French at Waterloo, but whereas the French army became a mere rabble, Lee withdrew his formidable soldiery with their courage unbroken, and their fighting power only diminished by their actual losses in the field. The decisive moment of the battle, and perhaps of the whole war, was in the afternoon of the third day, when Lee sent forward his choicest troops in a last effort to break the middle of the Union line. The center of the attacking force was Pickett's division, the flower of the Virginia infantry, but many other brigades took part in the assault, and the column, all told, numbered over 15,000 men. At the same time, the Confederates attacked the Union left to create a diversion. The attack was preceded by a terrific cannonade, Lee gathering 115 guns and opening a fire on the center of the Union line. In response, Hunt, the Union chief of artillery, and Tyler of the artillery reserves, gathered 80 guns on the crest of the gently sloping hill where attack was threatened. For 2 hours, from 1 till 3, the cannonade lasted, and the batteries on both sides suffered severely. In both the Union and Confederate lines, caissons were blown up by the fire, riderless horses dashed hither and thither, the dead lay in heaps, and throngs of wounded streamed to the rear. Every man lay down and sought what cover he could. It was evident that the Confederate cannonade was but a prelude to the great infantry attack, and at 3 o'clock Hunt ordered the fire to stop, that the guns might cool, to be ready for the coming assault. The Confederates thought that they had silenced the hostile artillery, and for a few minutes their firing continued. Then, suddenly, it ceased, and there was a lull. The men on the Union side who were not at the point directly menaced peered anxiously across the space between the lines to watch the next move, while the men in the divisions, which it was certain were about to be assaulted, lay hugging the ground and gripping their muskets, excited, but confident and resolute. They saw the smoke clouds rise slowly from the opposite crest where the Confederate army lay, and the sunlight glinted again on the long line of brass and iron guns which had been hidden from view during the cannonade. In another moment, out of the lifting smoke there appeared, beautiful and terrible, the picked thousands of the Southern army coming on to the assault. They advanced in three lines, each over a mile long, and in perfect order. Pickett's Virginians held the center, with on their left the North Carolinians of Pender and Pettigrew, and on their right the Alabama regiments of Wilcox, and there were also Georgian and Tennessee regiments in the attacking force. Pickett's division, however, was the only one able to press its charge home. After leaving the woods where they started, the Confederates had nearly a mile and a half to go in their charge. As the Virginians moved, they bent slightly to the left, so as to leave a gap between them and the Alabamians on the right. The Confederate lines came on magnificently. As they crossed the Emmitsburg Pike, the 80 guns on the Union crest, now cool and in good shape, opened upon them, first with shot and then with shell. Great gaps were made every second in the ranks, but the gray-clad soldiers closed up to the center, and the color-bearers leaped to the front, shaking and waving the flags. The Union infantry reserved their fire until the Confederates were within easy range, when the musketry crashed out with a roar, and the big guns began to fire grape and canister. On came the Confederates, the men falling by hundreds, the colors fluttering in front like a little forest, for as fast as a color-bearer was shot, someone else seized the flag from his hand before it fell. The North Carolinians were more exposed to the fire than any other portion of the attacking force, and they were broken before they reached the line. There was a gap between the Virginians and the Alabama troops, and this was taken advantage of by Stannard's Vermont Brigade and a demi-brigade under Gates of the 20th New York, who were thrust forward into it. Stannard charged front with his regiments and fell on Pickett's forces in flank, and Gates continued the attack. When thus struck in the flank, the Virginians could not defend themselves, and they crowded off toward the center to avoid the pressure. Many of them were killed or captured, many were driven back, but two of the brigades, headed by General Armistead, forced their way forward to the stone wall on the crest, where the Pennsylvania regiments were posted under Gibbon and Webb. The Union guns fired to the last moment, until of the two batteries immediately in front of the charging Virginians, every officer but one had been struck. One of the mortally wounded officers was young Cushing, a brother of the hero of the Albemarle fight. He was almost cut in two, but holding his body together with one hand, with the other he fired his last gun and fell dead, just as Armistead, pressing forward at the head of his men, leaped the wall, waving his hat on his sword. Immediately afterward the battle flags of the foremost Confederate regiments crowned the crest, but their strength was spent. The Union troops moved forward with the bayonet, and the remnant of Pickett's division, attacked on all sides, either surrendered or retreated down the hill again. Armistead fell, dying, by the body of the dead Cushing. Both Gibbon and Webb were wounded. Of Pickett's command, two-thirds were killed, wounded, or captured, and every brigade commander and every field officer, save one, fell. The Virginians tried to rally, but were broken and driven again by Gates, while Stannard repeated, at the expense of the Alabamians, the movement he had made against the Virginians, and reversing his front, attacked them in flank. Their lines were torn by the batteries in front, and they fell back before the Vermonters' attack, and Stannard reaped a rich harvest of prisoners and of battle flags. The charge was over. It was the greatest charge in any battle of modern times, and it had failed. It would be impossible to surpass the gallantry of those that made it, or the gallantry of those that withstood it. Had there been in command of the Union army a general like Grant, it would have been followed by a countercharge, and in all probability the war would have been shortened by nearly 2 years, but no countercharge was made. As the afternoon waned, a fierce cavalry fight took place on the Union right. Stuart, the famous Confederate cavalry commander, had moved forward to turn the Union right, but he was met by Gregg's cavalry, and there followed a contest at close quarters with the White Arm. It closed with a desperate melee, in which the Confederates, charged under Generals Wade Hampton and Fitz Lee, were met in mid-career by the Union generals Custer and McIntosh. All four fought, saber in hand, at the head of their troopers, and every man on each side was put into the struggle. Custer, his yellow hair flowing, his face aflame with the eager joy of battle, was in the thick of the fight, rising in his stirrups as he called out to his famous Michigan swordsmen, "Come on, you wolverines, come on!" All that the Union infantry, watching eagerly from their lines, could see was a vast dust cloud where flakes of light shimmered in the sun shone upon the swinging sabers. At last the Confederate horsemen were beaten back, and they did not come forward again or seek to renew the combat, for Pickett's charge had failed, and there was no longer hope of Confederate victory. When night fell, the Union flags waved in triumph on the field of Gettysburg. But over 30,000 men lay dead or wounded, strewn through wood and meadow, on field and hill, where the 3 days' fight had surged. End of the Charge at Gettysburg by Theodore Roosevelt. General Grant and the Vicksburg Campaign, from Hero Tales from American History. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by David Leeson. Hero Tales from American History by Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt. General Grant and the Vicksburg Campaign, written by Henry Cabot Lodge. What flag is this you carry along the sea and shore? The same our grandsires lifted up, the same our fathers bore. In many a battle's tempest it shed the crimson rain. What God has woven in his loom, let no man rend in twain. To Canaan, the Lord has led us forth, to plant upon the rebel towers the banners of the North. Holmes. On January 29, 1863, General Grant took command of the army intended to operate against Vicksburg, the last place held by the rebels on the Mississippi, and the only point at which they could cross the river and keep up communication with their armies and territory in the southwest. It was the first high ground below Memphis, was very strongly fortified, and was held by a large army under General Pemberton. The complete possession of the Mississippi was absolutely essential to the national government, because the control of that great river would cut the Confederacy in two, and do more, probably, than anything else to make the overthrow of the rebellion both speedy and certain. The natural way to invest and capture so strong a place, defended and fortified as Vicksburg was, would have been, if the axioms of the art of war had been adhered to, by a system of gradual approaches. A strong base should have been established at Memphis, and then the army and the fleet moved gradually forward, building storehouses and taking strong positions as they went. To do this, however, it first would have been necessary to withdraw the army from the positions it then held not far above Vicksburg, on the western bank of the river. But such a movement at that time would not have been understood by the country, and would have had a discouraging effect on the public mind, which it was most essential to avoid. The elections of 1862 had gone against the government, and there was great discouragement throughout the North. Voluntary enlistments had fallen off, a draft had been ordered, and the peace party was apparently gaining rapidly in strength. General Grant, looking at this grave political situation with the eye of a statesman, decided, as a soldier, that under no circumstances would he withdraw the army, but that, whatever happened, he would press forward to a decisive victory. In this determination he never faltered, but drove straight at his object until, 5 months later, the great Mississippi stronghold fell before him. Efforts were made through the winter to reach Vicksburg from the north by cutting canals and by attempts to get in through the bayous and tributary streams of the great river. All these expedients failed, however, one after another, as Grant, from the beginning, had feared that they would. He, therefore, took another and widely different line, and determined to cross the river from the western to the eastern bank below Vicksburg to the south. With the aid of the fleet, which ran the batteries successfully, he moved his army down the west bank until he reached a point beyond the possibility of attack, while a diversion by Sherman at Haynes Bluff above Vicksburg kept Pemberton in his fortifications. On April 26, Grant began to move his men over the river and landed them at Bruinsburg. "When this was effected," he writes, "I felt a degree of relief scarcely ever equaled since. Vicksburg was not yet taken, it is true, nor were its defenders demoralized by any of our previous movements. I was now in the enemy's country, with a vast river and the stronghold of Vicksburg between me and my base of supplies, but I was on dry ground, on the same side of the river with the enemy." The situation was this. The enemy had about 60,000 men at Vicksburg, Haynes Bluff, and at Jackson, Mississippi, about 50 miles east of Vicksburg. Grant, when he started, had about 33,000 men. It was absolutely necessary for success that Grant, with inferior numbers, should succeed in destroying the smaller forces to the eastward, and thus prevent their union with Pemberton and the main army at Vicksburg. His plan, in brief, was to fight and defeat a superior enemy separately and in detail. He lost no time in putting his plan into action, and pressing forward quickly, met a detachment of the enemy at Port Gibson and defeated them. Thence he marched to Grand Gulf on the Mississippi, which he took, and which he had planned to make a base of supply. When he reached Grand Gulf, however, he found that he would be obliged to wait a month, in order to obtain the reinforcements which he expected from General Banks at Port Hudson. He, therefore, gave up the idea of making Grand Gulf a base, and Sherman, having now joined him with his corps, Grant struck at once into the interior. He took nothing with him except ammunition, and his army was in the lightest marching order. This enabled him to move with great rapidity, but deprived him of his wagon trains, and of all munitions of war except cartridges. Everything, however, in this campaign depended on quickness, and Grant's decision, as well as all his movements, marked the genius of the great soldier, which consists very largely in knowing just when to abandon the accepted military axioms. Pressing forward, Grant met the enemy, numbering between 7,000 and 8,000, at Raymond, and readily defeated them. He then marched on toward Jackson, fighting another action at Clinton, and at Jackson he struck General Joseph Johnston, who had arrived at that point to take command of all the rebel forces. Johnston had with him, at the moment, about 11,000 men, and stood his ground. There was a sharp fight, but Grant easily defeated the enemy and took possession of the town. This was an important point, for Jackson was the capital of the state of Mississippi and was a base of military supplies. Grant destroyed the factories and the munitions of war which were gathered there, and also came into possession of the line of railroad which ran from Jackson to Vicksburg. While he was thus engaged, an intercepted message revealed to him the fact that Pemberton, in accordance with Johnston's orders, had come out of Vicksburg with 25,000 men, and was moving eastward against him. Pemberton, however, instead of holding a straight line against Grant, turned at first to the south with the view of breaking the latter's line of communication. This was not a success, for as Grant says with grim humor, "I had no line of communication to break," and, moreover, it delayed Pemberton when delay was of value to Grant in finishing Johnston. After this useless turn to the southward, Pemberton resumed his march to the east, as he should have done in the beginning, in accordance with Johnston's orders. But Grant was now more than ready. He did not wait the coming of Pemberton. Leaving Jackson as soon as he heard of the enemy's advance from Vicksburg, he marched rapidly westward and struck Pemberton at Champion Hills. The forces were at this time very nearly matched, and the severest battle of the campaign ensued, lasting 4 hours. Grant, however, defeated Pemberton completely, and came very near capturing his entire force. With a broken army, Pemberton fell back on Vicksburg. Grant pursued without a moment's delay, and came up with the rear guard at Big Black River. A sharp engagement followed, and the Confederates were again defeated. Grant then crossed the Big Black, and the next day was before Vicksburg, with his enemy inside the works. When Grant crossed the Mississippi at Bruinsburg and struck into the interior, he, of course, passed out of communication with Washington, and he did not hear from there again until May 11, when just as his troops were engaging in the Battle of Black River Bridge, an officer appeared from Port Hudson with an order from General Halleck to return to Grand Gulf and thence cooperate with Banks against Port Hudson. Grant replied that the order came too late. The bearer of the dispatch insisted that I ought to obey the order, and was giving arguments to support the position, when I heard a great cheering to the right of our line, and looking in that direction, saw Lawler, in his shirt sleeves, leading a charge on the enemy. I immediately mounted my horse and rode in the direction of the charge, and saw no more of the officer who had delivered the message. I think not even to this day. When Grant reached Vicksburg, there was no further talk of recalling him to Grand Gulf or Port Hudson. The authorities at Washington then saw plainly enough what had been done in the interior of Mississippi, far from the reach of telegraphs or mail. As soon as the National troops reached Vicksburg, an assault was attempted, but the place was too strong, and the attack was repulsed with heavy loss. Grant then settled down to a siege, and Lincoln and Halleck now sent him ample reinforcements. He no longer needed to ask for them. His campaign had explained itself, and in a short time he had 70,000 men under his command. His lines were soon made so strong that it was impossible for the defenders of Vicksburg to break through them, and although Johnston had gathered troops again to the eastward, an assault from that quarter on the National Army, now so largely reinforced, was practically out of the question. Tighter and tighter Grant drew his lines about the city, where every day the suffering became more intense. It is not necessary to give the details of the siege. On July 4, 1863, Vicksburg surrendered. The Mississippi was in control of the National forces from its source to its mouth, and the Confederacy was rent in twain. On the same day, Lee was beaten at Gettysburg, and these two great victories really crushed the rebellion, although much hard fighting remained to be done before the end was reached. Grant's campaign against Vicksburg deserves to be compared with that of Napoleon, which resulted in the fall of Ulm. It was the most brilliant single campaign of the war. With an inferior force, and abandoning his lines of communication, moving with a marvelous rapidity through a difficult country, Grant struck the superior forces of the enemy on the line from Jackson to Vicksburg. He crushed Johnston before Pemberton could get to him, and he flung Pemberton back into Vicksburg before Johnston could rally from the defeat which had been inflicted. With an inferior force, Grant was superior at every point of contest, and he won every fight. measured by the skill displayed and the result achieved, there is no campaign in our history which better deserves study and admiration. End of General Grant and the Vicksburg Campaign by Henry Cabot Lodge. Robert Gould Shaw, from Hero Tales from American History. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by David Leeson. Hero Tales from American History by Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt. Robert Gould Shaw, written by Henry Cabot Lodge. Brave, good, and true, I see him stand before me now, and read again on that young brow where every hope was new, how sweet were life. Yet, by the mouth firm set, and look made up for duty's utmost debt, I could divine he knew that death within the sulphurous hostile lines, in the mere wreck of nobly pitched designs, plucks heart's ease, and not rue. Right in the van, on the red rampart's slippery swell, with heart that beat a charge, he fell, foeward, as fits a man. But the high soul burns on to light men's feet where death for noble ends makes dying sweet. His life her crescent's span, orbs full with share in their undarkening days, whoever climbed the battalious steeps of praise since valor's praise began. We bide our chance, unhappy, and make terms with fate, a little more to let us wait. He leads for aye the advance. Hope's forlorn hopes that plant the desperate good for nobler earths and days of manlier mood. Our wall of circumstance cleared at a bound, he flashes o'er the fight, a saintly shape of fame, to cheer the right and steel each wavering glance. I write of one, while with dim eyes I think of three. Who weeps not others fair and brave as he? Ah, when the fight is won, dear land, whom triflers now make bold to scorn, thee from whose forehead earth awaits her morn, how nobler shall the sun flame in thy sky, how braver breathe thy air, that thou bred'st children who for thee could dare and die as thine have done. Lowell. Robert Gould Shaw was born in Boston on October 10, 1837, the son of Francis and Sarah Sturgis Shaw. When he was about 9 years old, his parents moved to Staten Island, and he was educated there and at school in the neighborhood of New York until he went to Europe in 1853, where he remained traveling and studying for the next 3 years. He entered Harvard College in 1856, and left at the end of his third year in order to accept an advantageous business offer in New York. Even as a boy, he took much interest in politics, and especially in the question of slavery. He voted for Lincoln in 1860, and at that time enlisted as a private in the New York 7th Regiment, feeling that there was likelihood of trouble, and that there would be a demand for soldiers to defend the country. His foresight was justified only too soon, and on April 19, 1861, he marched with his regiment to Washington. The call for the 7th Regiment was only for 30 days, and at the expiration of that service he applied for and obtained a commission as second lieutenant in the 2nd Massachusetts, and left with that regiment for Virginia in July 1861. He threw himself eagerly into his new duties, and soon gained a good position in the regiment. At Cedar Mountain he was an aide on General Gordon's staff, and was greatly exposed in the performance of his duties during the action. He was also with his regiment at Antietam, and was in the midst of the heavy fighting of that great battle. Early in 1863, the government determined to form Negro regiments, and Governor Andrew offered Shaw, who had now risen to the rank of captain, the colonelcy of one to be raised in Massachusetts, the first black regiment recruited under state authority. It was a great compliment to receive this offer, but Shaw hesitated as to his capacity for such a responsible post. He first wrote a letter declining, on the ground that he did not feel that he had ability enough for the undertaking, and then changed his mind, and telegraphed Governor Andrew that he would accept. It is not easy to realize it now, but his action then in accepting this command required high moral courage, of a kind quite different from that which he had displayed already on the field of battle. The prejudice against the blacks was still strong even in the North. There was a great deal of feeling among certain classes against enlisting black regiments at all, and the officers who undertook to recruit and lead Negroes were exposed to much attack and criticism. Shaw felt, however, that this very opposition made it all the more incumbent on him to undertake the duty. He wrote on February 8, "After I have undertaken this work, I shall feel that what I have to do is to prove that the Negro can be made a good soldier. I am inclined to think that the undertaking will not meet with so much opposition as was at first supposed. All sensible men in the army, of all parties, after a little thought, say that it is the best thing that can be done, and surely those at home who are not brave or patriotic enough to enlist should not ridicule or throw obstacles in the way of men who are going to fight for them. There is a great prejudice against it, but now that it has become a government matter, that will probably wear away. At any rate, I shan't be frightened out of it by its unpopularity. I feel convinced that I shall never regret having taken this step, as far as I myself am concerned, for while I was undecided, I felt ashamed of myself as if I were cowardly." Colonel Shaw went at once to Boston, after accepting his new duty, and began the work of raising and drilling the 54th Regiment. He met with great success, for he and his officers labored heart and soul, and the regiment repaid their efforts. On March 30, he wrote, "The mustering officer who was here today is a Virginian, and has always thought it was a great joke to try to make soldiers of niggers, but he tells me now that he has never mustered in so fine a set of men, though about 20,000 had passed through his hands since September." On May 28, Colonel Shaw left Boston, and his march through the city was a triumph. The appearance of his regiment made a profound impression, and was one of the events of the war which those who saw it never forgot. The regiment was ordered to South Carolina, and when they were off Cape Hatteras, Colonel Shaw wrote, "The more I think of the passage of the 54th through Boston, the more wonderful it seems to me. Just remember our own doubts and fears, and other people's sneering and pitying remarks when we began last winter, and then look at the perfect triumph of last Thursday. We have gone quietly along, forming the first regiment, and at last left Boston amidst greater enthusiasm than has been seen since the first 3 months' troops left for the war. Truly, I ought to be thankful for all my happiness and my success in life so far, and if the raising of colored troops proves such a benefit to the country and to the blacks as many people think it will, I shall thank God a thousand times that I was led to take my share in it." He had, indeed, taken his share in striking one of the most fatal blows to the barbarism of slavery which had yet been struck. The formation of the black regiments did more for the emancipation of the Negro and the recognition of his rights than almost anything else. It was impossible after that to say that men who fought and gave their lives for the Union and for their own freedom were not entitled to be free. The acceptance of the command of a black regiment by such men as Shaw and his fellow officers was the great act which made all this possible. After reaching South Carolina, Colonel Shaw was with his regiment at Port Royal and on the islands of that coast for rather more than a month, and on July 18 he was offered the post of honor in an assault upon Fort Wagner, which was ordered for that night. He had proved that the Negroes could be made into a good regiment, and now the second great opportunity had come, to prove their fighting quality. He wanted to demonstrate that his men could fight side by side with white soldiers, and show to somebody beside their officers what stuff they were made of. He therefore accepted the dangerous duty with gladness. Late in the day the troops were marched across Folly and Morris Islands and formed in line of battle within 600 yards of Fort Wagner. At 7:30 the order for the charge was given, and the regiment advanced. When they were within 100 yards of the fort, the rebel fire opened with such effect that the 1st Battalion hesitated and wavered. Colonel Shaw sprang to the front and, waving his sword, shouted, "Forward, 54th!" With another cheer, the men rushed through the ditch and gained a parapet on the right. Colonel Shaw was one of the first to scale the walls. As he stood erect, a noble figure, ordering his men forward and shouting them to press on, he was shot dead and fell into the fort. After his fall, the assault was repulsed. General Haywood, commanding the rebel forces, said to a Union prisoner, "I knew Colonel Shaw before the war, and then esteemed him. Had he been in command of white troops, I should have given him an honorable burial. As it is, I shall bury him in the common trench with the negroes that fell with him." He little knew that he was giving the dead soldier the most honorable burial that man could have devised, for the savage words told unmistakably that Robert Shaw's work had not been in vain. The order to bury him with his "niggers," which ran through the North and remained fixed in our history, showed in a flash of light the hideous barbarism of a system which made such things and such feelings possible. It also showed that slavery was wounded to the death, and that the brutal phrase was the angry snarl of a dying tiger. Such words rank with the action of Charles Stuart, when he had the bones of Oliver Cromwell and Robert Blake torn from their graves and flung on dunghills or fixed on Temple Bar. Robert Shaw fell in battle at the head of his men, giving his life to his country, as did many other gallant men during those 4 years of conflict. But he did something more than this. He faced prejudice and hostility in the North, and confronted the blind and savage rage of the South, in order to demonstrate to the world that the human beings who were held in bondage could vindicate their right to freedom by fighting and dying for it. He helped mightily in the great task of destroying human slavery, and in uplifting an oppressed and downtrodden race. He brought to this work the qualities which were particularly essential for his success. He had all that birth and wealth, breeding, education, and tradition could give. He offered up, in full measure, all those things which make life most worth living. He was handsome and beloved. He had a serene and beautiful nature, and was at once brave and simple. Above all things, he was fitted for the task which he performed and for the sacrifice which he made. The call of the country and of the time came to him, and he was ready. He has been singled out for remembrance from among many others of equal sacrifice, and a monument is rising to his memory in Boston, because it was his peculiar fortune to live and die for a great principle of humanity, and to stand forth as an ideal and beautiful figure in a struggle where the onward march of civilization was at stake. He lived in those few and crowded years a heroic life, and he met a heroic death. When he fell, sword in hand, on the parapet of Wagner, leading his black troops in a desperate assault, we can only say of him as Bunyan said of Valiant for Truth, "And then he passed over, and all the trumpets sounded for him on the other side." End of Robert Gould Shaw by Henry Cabot Lodge. Charles Russell Lowell, from Hero Tales from American History. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by David Leeson. Hero Tales from American History by Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt. Charles Russell Lowell, written by Henry Cabot Lodge. What's words to them whose faith and truth on war's red techstone rang true metal, who ventered life and love and youth for the great prize of death in battle? To him who, deadly hurt, again flashed on afore the charge's thunder, tipping with fire the bolt of men that rived the rebel line asunder. Lowell. Charles Russell Lowell was born in Boston, January 2, 1835. He was the eldest son of Charles Russell and Anna Cabot Jackson Lowell, and the nephew of James Russell Lowell. He bore the name, distinguished in many branches, of a family which was of the best New England stock. Educated in Boston public schools, he entered Harvard College in 1850. Although one of the youngest members of his class, he went rapidly to the front and graduated not only the first scholar of his year, but the foremost man of his class. He was, however, much more than a fine scholar, for even then he showed unusual intellectual qualities. He read widely and loved letters. He was a student of philosophy and religion, a thinker, and, best of all, a man of ideals, the glory of youth, as he called them in his valedictory oration. But he was something still better and finer than a mere idealist. He was a man of action, eager to put his ideals into practice and bring them to the test of daily life. With his mind full of plans for raising the condition of working men while he made his own career, he entered the iron mills of the Ames Company at Chicopee. Here he remained as a working man for 6 months, and then received an important post in the Trenton Iron Works of New Jersey. There his health broke down. Consumption threatened him, and all his bright hopes and ambitions were overcast and checked. He was obliged to leave his business and go to Europe, where he traveled for 2 years, fighting the dread disease that was upon him. In 1858 he returned and took a position on a Western railroad. Although the work was new to him, he manifested the same capacity that he had always shown, and more especially his power over men and his ability in organization. In 2 years his health was re-established, and in 1860 he took charge of the Mount Savage Iron Works at Cumberland, Maryland. He was there when news came of the attack made by the mob upon the 6th Massachusetts Regiment in Baltimore. 2 days later he had made his way to Washington, one of the first comers from the North, and at once applied for a commission in the regular army. While he was waiting, he employed himself in looking after the Massachusetts troops, and also, it is understood, as a scout for the government, dangerous work which suited his bold and adventurous nature. In May he received his commission as captain in the United States Cavalry. Employed at first in recruiting and then in drill, he gave himself up to the study of tactics and the science of war. The career above all others to which he was suited had come to him. The field at last lay open before him, where all his great qualities of mind and heart, his high courage, his power of leadership and of organization, and his intellectual powers could find full play. He moved rapidly forward, just as he had already done in college and in business. His regiment, in 1862, was under Stoneman in the peninsula, and was engaged in many actions, where Lowell's cool bravery made him constantly conspicuous. At the close of the campaign, he was breveted major, for distinguished services at Williamsburg and Slatersville. In July, Lowell was detailed for duty as an aide to General McClellan. At Malvern Hill and South Mountain his gallantry and efficiency were strongly shown, but it was at Antietam that he distinguished himself most. Sent with orders to General Sedgwick's division, he found it retreating in confusion under a hot fire. He did not stop to think of orders, but rode rapidly from point to point of the line, rallying company after company by the mere force and power of his word and look, checking the rout, while the storm of bullets swept all around him. His horse was shot under him, a ball passed through his coat, another broke his sword hilt, but he came off unscathed, and his service was recognized by his being sent to Washington with the captured flags of the enemy. The following winter he was ordered to Boston, to recruit a regiment of cavalry, of which he was appointed colonel. While the recruiting was going on, a serious mutiny broke out, but the man who, like Cromwell's soldiers, rejoiced greatly in the day of battle, was entirely capable of meeting this different trial. He shot the ringleader dead, and by the force of his own strong will quelled the outbreak completely and at once. In May, he went to Virginia with his regiment, where he was engaged in resisting and following Mosby, and the following summer he was opposed to General Early in the neighborhood of Washington. On July 14, when on a reconnaissance his advance guard was surprised, and he met them retreating in wild confusion, with the enemy at their heels, Riding into the midst of the fugitives, Lowell shouted, "Dismount!" The sharp word of command, the presence of the man himself, and the magic of discipline prevailed. The men sprang down, drew up in line, received the enemy with a heavy fire, and as the assailants wavered, Lowell advanced at once and saved the day. In July, he was put in command of the Provisional Brigade and joined the Army of the Shenandoah, of which in August General Sheridan took command. He was so struck with Lowell's work during the next month that in September he put him in command of the Reserved Brigade, a very fine body of cavalry and artillery. In the fierce and continuous fighting that ensued, Lowell was everywhere conspicuous, and in 13 weeks he had as many horses shot under him. But he now had scope to show more than the dashing gallantry which distinguished him always and everywhere. His genuine military ability, which surely would have led him to the front rank of soldiers had his life been spared, his knowledge, vigilance, and nerve all now became apparent. One brilliant action succeeded another, but the end was drawing near. It came at last on the famous day of Cedar Creek, when Sheridan rode down from Winchester and saved the battle. Lowell had advanced early in the morning on the right, and his attack prevented the disaster on that wing which fell upon the surprised army. He then moved to cover the retreat, and around to the extreme left, where he held his position near Middletown against repeated assaults. Early in the day his last horse was shot under him, and a little later, in a charge at 1 o'clock, he was struck in the right breast by a spent ball, which embedded itself in the muscles of the chest. Voice and strength left him. "It is only my poor lung," he announced, as they urged him to go to the rear. "You would not have me leave the field without having shed blood." As a matter of fact, the poor lung had collapsed, and there was an internal hemorrhage. He lay thus, under a rude shelter, for an hour and a half, and then came the order to advance along the whole line, the victorious advance of Sheridan and the rallied army. Lowell was helped to his saddle. "I feel well now," he whispered, and giving his orders through one of his staff, had his brigade ready first. Leading the great charge, he dashed forward, and just when the fight was hottest, a sudden cry went up, "The colonel is hit!" He fell from the saddle, struck in the neck by a ball which severed the spine, and was borne by his officers to a house in the village, where, clear in mind and calm in spirit, he died a few hours afterward. "I do not think there was a quality," said General Sheridan, "which I could have added to Lowell. He was the perfection of a man and a soldier." On October 19, the very day on which he fell, his commission was signed to be a brigadier general. This was a noble life and a noble death, worthy of much thought and admiration from all men. Yet this is not all. It is well for us to see how such a man looked upon what he was doing and what it meant to him. Lowell was one of the silent heroes so much commended by Carlyle. He never wrote of himself or his own exploits. As someone well said, he had the impersonality of genius. But in a few remarkable passages in his private letters, we can see how the meaning of life and of that great time unrolled itself before his inner eyes. In June 1861 he wrote, "I cannot say I take any great pleasure in the contemplation of the future. I fancy you feel much as I do about the profitableness of a soldier's life, and would not think of trying it, were it not for a muddled and twisted idea that somehow or other this fight was going to be one in which decent men ought to engage for the sake of humanity. I use the word in its ordinary sense. It seems to me that within a year the slavery question will again take a prominent place, and that many cases will arise in which we may get fearfully in the wrong if we put our cause wholly in the hands of fighting men and foreign legions." In June 1863 he wrote, "I wonder whether my theories about self-culture, etc., would ever have been modified so much, whether I should ever have seen what a necessary failure they lead to, had it not been for this war. Now I feel every day, more and more, that a man has no right to himself at all, that indeed he can do nothing useful unless he recognizes this clearly. Here again, on July 3, is a sentence which it is well to take to heart, and for all men to remember when their ears are deafened with the cry that war, no matter what the cause, is the worst thing possible, because it interferes with comfort, trade, and money-making. Wars are bad, Lowell writes, but there are many things far worse. Anything immediately comfortable in our affairs I don't see, but comfortable times are not the ones that make a nation great. On July 24, he says, "Many nations fail, that one may become great. Ours will fail, unless we gird up our loins and do humble and honest day's work, without trying to do the thing by the job, or to get a great nation made by a patent process. It is not safe to say that we shall not have victories till we are ready for them. We shall have victories, and whether or no we are ready for them depends upon ourselves. If we are not ready, we shall fail. Voilà tout. If you ask, what if we do fail, I have nothing to say. I shouldn't cry over a nation or two, more or less, gone under." Finally, on September 10, a little more than a month before his death, he wrote to a disabled officer, "I hope that you are going to live like a plain Republican, mindful of the beauty and of the duty of simplicity. Nothing fancy now, sir, if you please. It's disreputable to spend money when the government is so hard up, and when there are so many poor officers. I hope that you have outgrown all foolish ambitions, and are now content to become a useful citizen. Don't grow rich. If you once begin, you will find it much more difficult to be a useful citizen. Don't seek office, but don't disremember that the useful citizen always holds his time, his trouble, his money, and his life ready at the hint of his country. The useful citizen is a mighty, unpretending hero, but we are not going to have any country very long unless such heroism is developed. There, what a stale sermon I'm preaching. But being a soldier, it does seem to me that I should like nothing so well as being a useful citizen. Well, trying to be one, I mean. I shall stay in the service, of course, till the war is over, or till I'm disabled. But then I look forward to a pleasanter career. I believe I have lost all my ambitions. I don't think I would turn my hand to be a distinguished chemist or a famous mathematician. All I now care about is to be a useful citizen, with money enough to buy bread and firewood, and to teach my children to ride on horseback and look strangers in the face, especially southern strangers." There are profound and lofty lessons of patriotism and conduct in these passages, and a very noble philosophy of life and duty both as a man and as a citizen of a great republic. They throw a flood of light on the great underlying forces which enabled the American people to save themselves in that time of storm and stress. They are the utterances of a very young man, not 30 years old when he died in battle, but much beyond 30 in head and heart, tried and taught as he had been in a great war. What precisely such young men thought they were fighting for is put strikingly by Lowell's younger brother James, who was killed at Glendale, July 4, 1862. In 1861, James Lowell wrote to his classmates, who had given him a sword, "Those who died for the cause, not of the Constitution and the laws, a superficial cause, the rebels have now the same, but of civilization and law, and the self-restrained freedom which is their result. As the Greeks at Marathon and Salamis, Charles Martel and the Franks at Tours, and the Germans at the Danube, saved Europe from Asiatic barbarism, so we, at places to be famous in future times, shall have saved America from a similar tide of barbarism, and we may hope to be purified and strengthened ourselves by the struggle." This is a remarkable passage and a deep thought. Coming from a young fellow of 24, it is amazing. But the fiery trial of the times taught fiercely and fast, and James Lowell, just out of college, could see in the red light around him that not merely the freedom of a race and the saving of a nation were at stake, but that behind all this was the forward movement of civilization, brought once again to the arbitrament of the sword. Slavery was barbarous and barbarizing. It had dragged down the civilization of the South to a level from which it would take generations to rise up again. Was this barbarous force now to prevail in the United States in the 19th century? Was it to destroy a great nation and fetter human progress in the New World? That was the great question back of, beyond, and above all. Should this force of barbarism sweep conquering over the land, wrecking an empire in its onward march, or should it be flung back as Miltiades flung back Asia at Marathon and Charles Martel stayed the coming of Islam at Tours? The brilliant career, the shining courage, best seen always where the dead were lying thickest, the heroic death of Charles Lowell, are good for us all to know and to remember. Yet this imperfect story of his life has not been placed here for these things alone. Many thousand others, officers and soldiers alike, in the great Civil War gave their lives as freely as he, and brought to the service of their country the best that was in them. He was a fine example of many who, like him, offered up all they had for their country. But Lowell was also something more than this. He was a high type of a class, and a proof of certain very important things, and this is a point worthy of much consideration. The name of John Hampden stands out in the history of the English-speaking people, admired and unquestioned. He was neither a great statesman nor a great soldier. He was not a brilliant orator nor a famous writer. He fell bravely in an unimportant skirmish at Chalgrove Field, fighting for freedom and what he believed to be right. Yet he fills a great place in the past, both for what he did and what he was, and the reason for this is of high importance. John Hampden was a gentleman, with all the advantages that the accidents of birth could give. He was rich, educated, well-born, of high traditions. English civilization of that day could produce nothing better. The memorable fact is that when the time came for the test, he did not fail. He was a type of what was best among the English people, and when the call sounded, he was ready. He was brave, honest, high-minded, and he gave all, even his life, to his country. In the hour of need, the representative of what was best and most fortunate in England was put to the touch, and proved to be current gold. All men knew what that meant, and Hampden's memory is one of the glories of the English-speaking people. Charles Lowell has the same meaning for us when rightly understood. He had all that birth, breeding, education, and tradition could give. The resources of our American life and civilization could produce nothing better. How would he and such men as he stand the great ordeal when it came? If wealth, education, and breeding were to result in a class who could only carp and criticize, accumulate money, give way to self-indulgence, and cherish low foreign ideals, then would it have appeared that there was a radical unsoundness in our society? Refinement would have been proved to be weakness, and the highest education would have been shown to be a curse rather than a blessing. But Charles Lowell, and hundreds of others like him, in greater or less degree, all over the land, met the great test and emerged triumphant. The Harvard men may be taken as fairly representing the colleges and universities of America. Harvard had, in 1860, 4,157 living graduates and 823 students, presumably over 18 years old. Probably 3,000 of her students and graduates were of military age and not physically disqualified for military service. Of this number, 1,230 entered the Union Army or Navy. 156 died in service, and 67 were killed in action. Many did not go who might have gone, unquestionably, but the record is a noble one. Nearly one man of every two Harvard men came forward to serve his country when war was at our gates, and this proportion holds true, no doubt, of the other universities of the North. It is well for the country, well for learning, well for our civilization, that such a record was made at such a time. Charles Lowell, and those like him, showed once for all that the men to whom fortune had been kindest were capable of the noblest patriotism and shrank from no sacrifices. They taught the lesson which can never be heard too often, that the man to whom the accidents of birth and fortune have given most is the man who owes most to his country. If patriotism should exist anywhere, it should be strongest with such men as these, and their service should be ever ready. How nobly Charles Lowell, in this spirit, answered the great question, his life and death, alike victorious, show to all men. End of Charles Russell Lowell by Henry Cabot Lodge. Sheridan at Cedar Creek, from Hero Tales from American History. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by David Leeson. Hero Tales from American History by Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt. Sheridan at Cedar Creek, written by Henry Cabot Lodge. Inspired repulsed battalions to engage, and taught the doubtful battle where to rage. Addison. General Sheridan took command of the Army of the Shenandoah in August 1864. His coming was the signal for aggressive fighting, and for a series of brilliant victories over the rebel army. He defeated Early at Winchester and again at Fisher's Hill, while General Torbert whipped Rosser in a subsequent action, where the rout of the rebels was so complete that the fight was known as the Woodstock Races. Sheridan's plan after this was to terminate his campaign north of Staunton, and returning thence to desolate the valley so as to make it untenable for the Confederates, as well as useless as a granary or storehouse, and then move the bulk of his army through Washington and unite them with General Grant in front of Petersburg. Grant, however, and the authorities at Washington were in favor of Sheridan's driving Early into eastern Virginia and following up that line, which Sheridan himself believed to be a false move. This important matter was in debate until October 16, when Sheridan, having left the main body of his army at Cedar Creek under General Wright, determined to go to Washington and discuss the question personally with General Halleck and the Secretary of War. He reached Washington on the morning of the 17th about 8 o'clock, left there at 12, and got back to Martinsburg the same night about dark. At Martinsburg he spent the night, and the next day, with his escort, rode to Winchester, reaching that point between 3 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon of the 18th. He there heard that all was quiet at Cedar Creek and along the front, and went to bed, expecting to reach his headquarters and join the army the next day. About 6 o'clock on the morning of the 19th, it was reported to him that artillery firing could be heard in the direction of Cedar Creek, but as the sound was stated to be irregular and fitful, he thought it only a skirmish. He, nevertheless, arose at once, and had just finished dressing when another officer came in and reported that the firing was still going on in the same direction, but that it did not sound like a general battle. Still Sheridan was uneasy, and after breakfasting, mounted his horse between 8 and 9 o'clock and rode slowly through Winchester. When he reached the edge of the town he halted a moment, and then heard the firing of artillery in an unceasing roar. He now felt confident that a general battle was in progress, and as he rode forward, he was convinced from the rapid increase of the sound that his army was falling back. After he had crossed Mill Creek, just outside Winchester, and made the crest of the rise beyond the stream, there burst upon his view the spectacle of a panic-stricken army, hundreds of slightly wounded men, with hundreds more unhurt but demoralized, together with baggage wagons and trains, were all pressing to the rear in hopeless confusion. There was no doubt now that a disaster had occurred at the front. A fugitive told Sheridan that the army was broken and in full retreat, and that all was lost. Sheridan at once sent word to Colonel Edwards, commanding a brigade at Winchester, to stretch his troops across the valley and stop all fugitives. His first idea was to make a stand there, but as he rode along, a different plan flashed into his mind. He believed that his troops had great confidence in him, and he determined to try to restore their broken ranks, and instead of merely holding the ground at Winchester, to rally his army and lead them forward again to Cedar Creek. He had hardly made up his mind to this course when news was brought to him that his headquarters at Cedar Creek were captured and the troops dispersed. He started at once with about 20 men as an escort and rode rapidly to the front. As he passed along, the unhurt men who thickly lined the road recognized him, and as they did so, threw up their hats, shouldered their muskets, and followed him as fast as they could on foot. His officers rode out on either side to tell the stragglers that the general had returned, and as the news spread, the retreating men in every direction rallied and turned their faces toward the battlefield they had left. In his memoirs, Sheridan says, in speaking of his ride through the retreating troops, "I said nothing, except to remark as I rode among them, 'If I had been with you this morning, this disaster would not have happened. We must face the other way. We will go back and recover our camp.'" Thus he galloped on over the 20 miles, with the men rallying behind him and following him in ever-increasing numbers. As he went by, the panic of retreat was replaced by the ardor of battle. Sheridan had not overestimated the power of enthusiasm or his own ability to rouse it to fighting pitch. He pressed steadily on to the front until at last he came up to Getty's division of the 6th Corps, which, with the cavalry, were the only troops who held their line and were resisting the enemy. Getty's division was about a mile north of Middletown on some slightly rising ground, and were skirmishing with the enemy's pickets. Jumping a rail fence, Sheridan rode to the crest of the hill, and as he took off his hat, the men rose up from behind the barricades with cheers of recognition. It is impossible to follow in detail Sheridan's actions from that moment, but he first brought up the 19th Corps and the two divisions of Wright to the front. He then communicated with Colonel Lowell, who was fighting near Middletown with his men dismounted, and asked him if he could hold on where he was, to which Lowell replied in the affirmative. All this and many similar quickly given orders consumed a great deal of time, but still the men were getting into line, and at last, seeing that the enemy were about to renew the attack, Sheridan rode along the line so that the men could all see him. He was received with the wildest enthusiasm as he rode by, and the spirit of the army was restored. The rebel attack was made shortly after noon, and was repulsed by General Emory. This done, Sheridan again set to work to getting his line completely restored, while General Merritt charged and drove off an exposed battery of the Confederates. By 3:30, Sheridan was ready to attack. The fugitives of the morning, whom he had rallied as he rode from Winchester, were again in their places, and the different divisions were all disposed in their proper positions. With the order to advance, the whole line pressed forward. The Confederates at first resisted stubbornly, and then began to retreat. On they went past Cedar Creek, and there, where the pike made a sharp turn to the west toward Fisher's Hill, Merritt and Custer fell on the flank of the retreating columns, and the rebel army fell back, routed and broken, up the valley. The day had begun in rout and defeat. It ended in a great victory for the Union army. How near we had been to a terrible disaster can be realized by recalling what had happened before the general galloped down from Winchester. In Sheridan's absence, Early, soon after dawn, had made an unexpected attack on our army at Cedar Creek. Surprised by the assault, the National troops had given way in all directions, and a panic had set in. Getty's division with Lowell's cavalry held on at Middletown, but with this exception, the rout was complete. When Sheridan rode out of Winchester, he met an already beaten army. His first thought was the natural one to make a stand at Winchester and rally his troops about him there. His second thought was the inspiration of the great commander. He believed his men would rally as soon as they saw him. He believed that enthusiasm was one of the great weapons of war, and that this was the moment of all others when it might be used with decisive advantage. With this thought in his mind, he abandoned the idea of forming his men at Winchester and rode bareheaded through the fugitives, swinging his hat, straight for the front, and calling on his men as he passed to follow him. As the soldiers saw him, they turned and rushed after him. He had not calculated in vain upon the power of personal enthusiasm, but at the same time he did not rely upon any wild rush to save the day. The moment he reached the field of battle, he set to work with the coolness of a great soldier to make all the dispositions, first, to repel the enemy, and then to deliver an attack which could not be resisted. One division after another was rapidly brought into line and placed in position, the thin ranks filling fast with the soldiers who had recovered from their panic, and followed Sheridan and the Black Horse all the way down from Winchester. He had been already 2 hours on the field when, at noon, he rode along the line, again formed for battle. Most of the officers and men then thought he had just come, while in reality it was his own rapid work which had put them in the line along which he was riding. Once on the field of battle, the rush and hurry of the desperate ride from Winchester came to an end. First the line was reformed, then the enemy's assault was repulsed, and it was made impossible for them to again take the offensive. But Sheridan, undazzled by his brilliant success up to this point, did not mar his work by overhaste. 2 hours more passed before he was ready, and then, when all was prepared, with his ranks established and his army ranged in position, he moved his line forward, and won one of the most brilliant battles of the war, having, by his personal power over his troops and his genius in action, snatched a victory from a day which began in surprise, disaster, and defeat. End of Sheridan at Cedar Creek by Henry Cabot Lodge.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply, in-app only.